This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Grand Chessboard, 11 Years Later, Part 1, Target Russia, The Crisis in Georgia. On Thursday night, August 7th, Georgia's foreign minister telephoned the State Department in Washington and said, "The country is under attack. Georgia must protect its people." On August 11th, Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, wrote in the Wall Street Journal, "The war in Georgia is a war for the West. Russia threatens to undermine the stability of the international security system." As he wrote, "Russia is waging war on my country. On Friday, hundreds of Russian tanks crossed into the Georgian territory, and Russian Air Force jets bombed Georgian airports, bases, ports, and public markets. Many are dead. Many more are wounded. This invasion echoes Afghanistan in 1979 and the Prague Spring of 1968. It threatens to undermine the stability of the international security system. Why this war? This war is not of Georgia's making, nor is it Georgia's choice. The Kremlin designed this war." In the Los Angeles Times, August 12th, Max Boot writes, "Stand up to Russia." Putin, referring to Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, Putin appeared to have more than a passing resemblance to autocrats such as Mussolini and the Japanese generals of the 1930s, whose aggression had tragic repercussions. Indeed, two other historical analogies have come to mind: the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931 and the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in 1935. Both set the stage for World War II by revealing the impotence of the League of Nations and the unwillingness of the great powers to respond forcefully to aggression. Likewise, the Russian attacks on Georgia, if left unchecked, could easily trigger more conflict in the future. It didn't stop there. In the Wall Street Journal itself, the editorial, "Vladimir Bonaparte," referring to Vladimir Putin, "the farther Russia's tanks roll into Georgia, the more the world is beginning to see the reality of Vladimir Putin's Napoleonic ambitions. Having consolidated his authoritarian transition as prime minister with a figurehead president, Mr. Putin is now pushing to reassert Russian dominance in Eurasia. Ukraine is in his sights, and even the Baltic states could be threatened if he's allowed to get away with it." Concludes the Wall Street Journal, "The West needs to draw a line at Georgia." What is the reality? What is the basis for this crisis in Georgia? As we will discuss today and in the weeks to come on Taking Aim, this is all part of the U.S. strategy, the grand chessboard as outlined by Brzezinski in his seminal book written in 1997, The Grand Chessboard. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. We cited that book, in fact, at the very beginnings of Taking Aim in World Trade Center Uncensored History, in which we delineated the stratagems which had brought the United States to the point where it required a permanent war targeting 60 countries or more. Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor under Jimmy Carter, published a book entitled The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives in 1997, which, as we said at the time, is remarkable in its candor regarding U.S. imperial plans. Quote, "America's global primacy," Brzezinski wrote, the now chief advisor to Barack Obama, "is directly dependent upon how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained. The power that dominates Eurasia will control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions. Most of the world's physical wealth, Brzezinski continues, is there, both in its enterprises and underneath its soil. Eurasia, he said, accounts for 60% of the world's GNP and 75% of the world's known energy resources. And Brzezinski at the time spelled out the objective of U.S. military and imperial policy. Quote, "The Eurasian Balkans are infinitely more important as a potential economic prize with an enormous concentration of natural gas and oil reserves in the region. The Central Asian region and the Caspian Sea basin," Brzezinski writes, "are known to contain untold reserves of natural gas and oil that dwarf those of Kuwait, the Gulf of Mexico, and the North Sea taken together." Now, for over a decade, brothers and sisters, the major think tanks of the U.S. rulers prepared for the seizure of oil and natural gas in Central Asia, and in particular in the Caspian Sea basin. In fact, the U.S. Energy Information Administration prepared a series of studies over several years calculating the returns from U.S. seizure of Central Asian oil. Here's one report which we cited at the time, both in World Trade Center Uncensored History and again on October 9, 2002, in the article called "Permanent War, the Stakes for Working People." Quote, "By 2020, the United States will import 64% of its crude oil, 25.8 million barrels per day. Caspian region oil reserves are the third largest in the world, and within the next 15 years, they will offset Persian Gulf oil. Caspian Sea oil and gas are not the only hydrocarbon deposits in the region. Turkmenistan's Karakum Desert holds the world's third largest gas reserves, over 3 trillion cubic meters at present calculation. It has 6 billion barrels of oil reserves. Current estimates indicate, in addition to huge gas deposits, the Caspian Basin holds 200 billion barrels of oil, 33 times the holdings of Alaska's North Slope, with a current value of over $4 trillion, unquote. Now, this absolutely orgiastic anticipation of the objectives of U.S. imperialism are explicit. Here's U.S. News and World Report quoting a private memorandum to oil industry executives from Vice President Richard Cheney in 1998 in his capacity as CEO of Halliburton. Quote, "I cannot think of a time when we have had a region emerge so suddenly to become as strategically important and critical to us as the Caspian," unquote. The short-term gains from the oil and natural gas resources were then calculated by U.S. News and World Report at, again, $4 trillion. And Maya, here is Oil Politics, America and the Riches of the Caspian Basin, in the World Policy Journal in spring of 1998. Ian Bremmer examining the pipeline structure required to secure, quote, "proven oil reserves of 15 to 30 billion barrels with reserves of 200 billion and proven natural gas reserves of 350 trillion cubic feet," unquote. And what follows in this lengthy article is a calculation of how to impose U.S. will on the region, how to fragment the countries of the area, how to break up the former republics of the Soviet Union, how to secure their resources, how to overthrow their governments, how to impose upon them the type of rule that will submit them to U.S. imperial design. In his report at that time to the U.S. Heritage Foundation on July 25, 1997, Ariel Cohen did a calculation of these resources, and what does he come up with? Quote, $4 trillion at current market prices. And then he further estimates a vast and increasing bonanza, quote, in the region's reserves, similarly enormous. It's larger than those in all of North America, unquote. Under the heading "A Silk Road Blueprint," Ariel Cohen urged creation of, quote, "conditions in Afghanistan for the rapid construction of pipelines to carry this bonanza of profiteering to the Indian Ocean. And this theme was taken up by UNICAL's Vice President John Maresca, the former U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. It is a leitmotif. And everything that is unfolding today in Georgia, and everything that is unfolding in the press media with the very same individuals coming forth, is in service of this agenda around which trillions have been spent, all right, trillions of dollars on permanent war, trillions of dollars on the death of millions of people, and upon the destruction of a whole generation of American youth.
Ralph, we have to note that when Ariel Cohn was writing, oil was less than $10 a barrel. But oil went up to $150 a barrel before it started to come down recently.
A tenfold increase, we'd have it at $40 trillion. Your point is well taken because, in fact, as we know, brothers and sisters, crude oil went up to $150 a barrel. And with the unfolding wars that are intended, and we will discuss this in this series in particular detail, including the plans for attacking Iran, for which this war in Georgia in many respects is but a fainting action. These crude oil prices will be over $200 a barrel. Multi-trillions of dollars are at stake here. They kill, they wage wars, they engineer global conflicts for money and profits of that magnitude.
And as Ariel Cohn wrote recently, August 11th, in web memo for the Heritage Foundation, a pro-Russian regime in Georgia would bring the strategic Baku-Tbilisi-Sayan oil pipeline and the Baku-Erzurum pipeline, which is a gas pipeline, under Moscow's control. Such a development would undermine any options of pro-Western orientation for Azerbaijan and Armenia, along with any chances of resolving their conflict based on diplomacy and Western-style cooperation. What does this lead to? His subtitle, The West's Hour of Truth. The United States and its European allies must take all available diplomatic measures to stop Russian aggression. The U.S. and its allies need to demand that Russia withdraw all its troops from the territory of Georgia and recognize its territorial integrity. Furthermore, the U.S. and Europe need to internationalize this conflict. This is the real thrust of what Ariel Cohn is saying. Internationalize the conflict. It has been the position of William Kristol, the Evening Standard, Ariel Cohn, Max Boot, all these neocons. First, it was dismantle the Soviet Union, a strategy of Brzezinski, spelled out in the Grand Chessboard, and then break up the region even further, install through CIA assets, leadership in each of these nations, and capture the oil. The Baku-Tbilisi-Sayan oil pipeline was a key element in this and was supported by President Bill Clinton. It was then put under construction. We're going to discuss the details of it in the coming weeks. And the BTC oil pipeline runs through Georgia. Ralph?
The process that they are describing here is not merely the separation of the former Soviet Union from the republics that comprised it, not merely the enlisting of these former Soviet republics in NATO, and not merely the subordination of these governments and of these societies to imperial design, but their incorporation in a forward plan to break up Russia itself, to subject Russia to the fragmentation along ethnic lines that was part of the grand design, if you like, for the Arab East that was articulated by Oded Yinon, as we set forth, which is to break up each country in the Arab East into its ethnic and religious components. It's important, as you were citing, Maya, to spell out what Ariel Cohn, and again I want to remind our listeners that this is the very same Ariel Cohn of the Heritage Foundation who in July 25, 1997, set out the agenda under the heading The Silk Road Blueprint, calculating the $4 trillion, estimating the bonanza in the region's reserves. Now we are in the implementation of this 11 years later, And Cohen, in a web memo published by the Heritage Foundation, articulates this in great specificity. As the Olympic Games opened, a tragic and ominous conflict between Georgia and Russia erupted. On Thursday of last week, South Ossetian separatists, supported by Moscow, escalated machine gun and mortar fire attacks against neighboring Georgian villages. This Thursday and Friday past, Georgia attacked the capital, Chechen Valley, with artillery. Chechen Valley suffered severe damage, providing the pretext for Moscow's long-planned invasion of Georgia. Russia with overwhelming force. Putin flew from the Beijing Olympics to Vladikavkaz, taking control of military operations. He sidelined his successor, Dmitry Medvedev, leaving no doubt as to who is in charge. The 58th Russian Army of the North Caucasus Military District rolled into South Ossetia, reinforced by the 76th Airborne Pskov Division, and Cossacks from neighboring Georgian Russian territories moved in to combat the Georgians as well. Russia's goals for war with Georgia are far-reaching, Cohen states. Expulsion of Georgian troops. Termination of Georgian sovereignty. Regime change. Bringing down President Mikhail Saakashvili. Installing a pro-Russian leadership in Tbilisi. Preventing Georgia from joining NATO. Providing a message to Ukraine that its insistence on NATO membership will lead to war and its dismemberment, shifting control of the Caucasus and strategic energy pipelines by subjecting Georgia to Russian control, creating a 19th century sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union by the use of force. This is a siren call, a clarion call by Ariel Cohen, this imperial spokesperson for confrontation of a military nature with Russia, for the removal of Putin, and for the breakup of Russia itself.
Ralph, I mentioned before Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, the author of The Grand Chessboard. He had publicly said that Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, was following a course, quote, horrifyingly similar to that taken by Stalin and Hitler in the 1930s. John McCain, Republican Party presidential candidate, referred to the Soviet invasions of Czechoslovakia in 1968 and Hungary in 1956, and then went on to say, quote, today we are all Georgians, end quote. This is all leading up to direct involvement of the United States in Georgia. Georgia had applied to be a member of NATO. As a member of NATO, this would have meant immediate entry of NATO forces to the defense of Georgia. The reality is something else. August 13th, New York Times, after mixed U.S. messages, a war erupted in Georgia. And you see clearly from this article, as well as from articles in the Washington Post, that it was Georgia that attacked South Ossetia, the part of Georgia that has been, in a way, independent, is wanted full independence, but has been operating as an autonomous area since the breakup of the Soviet Union. That and another part of Georgia have been trying to split off from Georgia. The people of South Ossetia, which had a North Ossetia, which is actually part of Russia, the Ossetians are not Georgians. Ralph?
Many of these regions are multi-ethnic, and in fact, during the period of the Soviet Union, Georgians and Ossetians intermarried, and there wasn't an ethnic conflict of any marked kind, although in its inception, when Stalin consolidated his control, contrary to what Lenin had advocated, which was that the prison house of nations, as he called the Tsar's empire, should not be replicated in any remote sense by the new Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, but quite the contrary, revolutionary uprising had to be the work of the indigenous working class, that if indigenous peoples in those regions wanted to affiliate with the Soviet Union on an equal basis, that was to be their independent and democratic decision. On that very issue, Lenin broke with Stalin. Lenin and Trotsky formed an alliance just on the eve of Lenin's death. centering around that democratic demand. But notwithstanding that, in the formation of the Soviet Union and its consolidation under the heel of Stalin, the policy of subjugating these other republics was intrinsic to the bureaucratic rule that followed. But the demand of these peoples was to throw off that dictatorial control, not to separate and to fragment. The national aspirations of these peoples expressed themselves in wanting local control over their own affairs, not in becoming little duchies, little compartments to be subordinated to the imperial designs which were well understood by the peoples of these countries.
Ralph, the Ossetians, the primary ethnic grouping in South Ossetia, had originally been pushed out by the Mongols from what is now Russian territory. They were pushed out, and some of them migrated into Georgia. They had been originally in an area south of the Don River. Some settled in what is now North Ossetia, which came under Russian rule in 1767. South Ossetia, along with Georgia itself, was annexed in 1801 with the expansion of the Russian Empire. So there is a long history here, a very long history, and a demand for independence. The Republic of South Ossetia was declared in the early 1990s when there was a Georgian-Ossetian conflict, and the independence was not recognized by any member of the United Nations, and a so-called peacekeeping force was put in place, a peacekeeping force composed of Russian and CIS so-called peacekeepers. It is these forces, these so-called peacekeeping forces, that were attacked by the Georgians, and particularly a rain of destruction on the capital of South Ossetia on the evening of August 7th and into August 8th. This has caused the displacement, the United Nations has said, of 120,000 people and entire destruction of villages and towns, and what has emerged into an ethnic cleansing in the area. Ralph?
I think we should take a moment, Maya, to examine the orchestration of this big lie about what are the dynamics of the conflict in Georgia. Is widely understood across the world, the actual military operations were initiated by the Georgian regime, and the particular dynamics of those, namely the relationship of the Georgian regime to Israel and to American special forces, we will examine. But before doing that, I want to return to what you began to discuss, namely this litany of propaganda that has been orchestrated in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, in the Los Angeles Times, in the Guardian, in the Times of London, in Der Spiegel in Germany. And we should, in looking at what they say, examine who it is that is saying it. We start again with Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, as he was imposed. And as he writes, "When my government was swept into power by a peaceful revolution in 2004, we will examine what that revolution, as he calls it, was, we inherited a dysfunctional state. Plagued by unresolved conflicts dating to the early 90s, I pledged to reunify my country. I wanted the people living in conflict zones to share in a prosperous democratic country that Georgia could and has become," he writes. "As Europe expanded its security institutions to the Black Sea, my government appealed to the Western community of nations to play a leading role. The key to any resolution was to replace the outdated peacekeeping structures created two decades ago and dominated by Russia with a genuine international effort." And by international effort, he meant United States and European control. "My government, the future of my country is at stake. The people of Georgia have spoken with a loud and clear voice. We see our future in Europe. We are an ancient European nation. We are tied to Europe by culture and civilization and values. We support membership in NATO. These aims are not negotiable." And then it says, "Russia's future is at stake," he writes. "How can a Russia that wages aggressive war be a partner for Europe? Russia's leadership is bent on restoring neocolonial forms of control over the entire area once governed by Moscow. If Georgia falls, it means the fall of the West in the entire former Soviet Union and beyond. Leaders in neighboring states, in Ukraine, other Caucasian states, and throughout Central Asia have to consider whether the price of independence and freedom is too high. This is a clarion call in the Wall Street Journal, in the mouth of Saakashvili, for a dismantling of what? Of Russia. For removal of which regime? That of Putin. That of the Russian government. Indeed, the articulation of this is clear in Der Spiegel, in the voice of Richard Morningstar, and this on the 3rd of March of 2007, Opportunities for Transatlantic Cooperation in the Caspian Region. Natural resources, he writes, in the Caspian region are vital to Europe's future, to European Union's energy policy. The United States has not been focusing on the region since the 1990s, but European decision-makers have neglected its strategic importance. In July 2006, the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, which runs from the Caspian port of Baku through Azerbaijan and Georgia to the Mediterranean port of Ceyhan on the Turkish coast, became operational. The successful completion of this oil pipeline and the opening in coming months of a gas pipeline mirroring the BTC route allow us to ship Azerbaijani gas to Turkey and to Europe, and it makes clear the importance of the Caspian region to the United States and Europe. Translation, exclude Russia. Cut Russia out. Cut Russia off. Exclude them. Surround them and exclude them. The U.S. role in the Caspian, he writes. The opening of the BTC pipeline is the successful culmination of a consistent, bipartisan United States policy relating to Caspian Basin energy resources that has spanned the Clinton and Bush administrations. The objectives that serve as the framework for U.S. policy during the Clinton administration remain equally valid today. And he goes on to say, we need only look at the map of the greater Caspian region, stretching from Turkey to Kazakhstan, to realize its huge geopolitical and economic value and importance.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Grand Chessboard, 11 Years Later, Part 1, Target Russia, the Crisis in Georgia. Ralph?
Morningstar, under the heading The U.S. Role in the Caspian, is extremely clear. He states, the United States' strong interest in the Caspian dates to the breakup of the Soviet Union. Virtually overnight, 8 new independent states were brought into existence in an area rich with natural resources. Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan. The principal component of the U.S. policy is to help these new states develop as countries that will become market democracies in an uncertain part of the world. In addition, the United States believes that the development of the natural resources in the region provide an alternative supply of oil and gas at a time when South Asia and the Middle East are increasingly unstable and demand is soaring from India and China. The United States will make sure that these resources are available for development by American companies. American companies. We will ensure the security of these new countries, and multiple routes of access will be developed for resources to be exported from the region. The United States' position was and is that Russia will not be allowed to have a monopoly on pipelines transporting Caspian resources, and that no pipelines will go through Iran. Now, you talk about the audacity of imperialism. These are areas of the world where they are talking about nominally independent states, a region that is right in the heartland of Russia that affects its very resources and its self-sufficiency as a functioning economy and society, and they are brazenly declaring that they will create the pipelines, they will dominate the resources, and they will subordinate them to American corporations and companies with the profits allocated accordingly. Quote, with regard to the Eastern Caspian, the Caspian Pipeline Consortium consists primarily of Chevron and other oil companies. The United States has a strong interest in the development of Trans-Caspian gas from Turkmenistan across the Caspian Sea to Baku, which will then run parallel to the BTC pipeline to Turkey. This will then transport natural gas into Turkey, removing any reliance on Russia and Iran for gas supplies. In other words, isolate those countries and cut them off. And indeed, we have here in this long article a spelling out right now of the meaning of the grand chessboard and the full military and political implications thereof. Maya, I'm going to...
Ralph, before you continue, I'd like to go back in history, because what we're seeing now in the Caucasus happened with the introduction, the attempts of imperialism after the Russian Revolution. Also, after the Russian Revolution, in the first stages with the Mensheviks in power, and the Mensheviks in Georgia invited into the country foreign armed forces, first Germany and then England. We have General von Kress and General Walker, and they played an important part in the internal life of Georgia. Leon Trotsky, in Between Red and White, his Chapter 3, The Internal Regime, discusses what took place in Georgia at the time. And the purpose of the imperial forces of Germany and of England, as well as of the Menshevik forces, was to suppress the peasantry who were demanding agrarian reform, that is, saying that the pace of the revolution wasn't moving fast enough. And the rich peasants and the petty bourgeois and the former landed aristocracy in Georgia were counter to the demands of the peasants who wanted to fulfill the Russian Revolution.
Land, bread, and peace was the Bolshevik promise, and the peasants wanted the land. They wanted to have the land to till on which they had labored. They were promised that. That was their aspiration, and that was the great beacon of the revolution to the landless peasants, the virtual serf-like peasants in the entire area surrounding Russia at the time.
So the imperial forces were brought in, as I said, Germany, and then imperial forces from England to prop up what was taking place in Georgia and the revolts that were going on in Abkhazia in the west, which is another one of the parts of Georgia that has declared independence. We have at that time the Mensheviks imprisoning the Bolsheviks, those who were part of the Bolshevik party. The reports were of fires burning everywhere, the people fleeing, the British and the German forces fleeing the Mensheviks. By 1921, the Red Army moved into Georgia with the rise of the Bolshevik party in the Russian Revolution. And as Trotsky later writes in the balance sheet of the Finnish events, referring to Finland, this is what he wrote in April 1940, and he looked at the situation before of Georgia and then of Finland. He wrote, the Soviet Republic in 1921 forcefully Sovietized Georgia, which constituted an open gateway for imperialist assault in the Caucasus. From the standpoint of the principles of national self-determination, a good deal might have been said in objection to such Sovietization. But, he says, the safeguarding of the socialist revolution came first for them. World imperialism for a long time utilized the question of violence in Georgia as the rallying cry in mobilizing world public opinion against the Soviets. But what he describes in the prior piece that I mentioned is where the real violence originated. Ralph?
Trotsky, who was the creator of the Red Army, was describing the invasion by 14 countries on 21 fronts in what became the so-called Civil War. The Bolshevik insurrection took 10 lives. The invasion by 14 countries on 21 fronts cost nearly 7 million lives, devastated everything, and created a huge famine across the length and width of the Soviet Union, and particularly those countries that were the base of that invasion. And having that understanding, and not in any way suggesting that Putin is the continuator of the Bolshevik Revolution.
Nonetheless,
the basic imperial dynamics are today as they were then, but now with a brazenness and on a scale unprecedented. And I think, Maya, we should take a moment again. This orchestration, we've been discussing only a couple of the voices that have been filling the pages of the media in this past 10 days. Here, again, is Richard Morningstar on August 13th, 2008, a year later. "Russia must not have a stranglehold on resources," is his headline in Der Spiegel. "The world's second largest oil pipeline goes directly through Georgia. Its construction was pushed through by the United States against Russia's will. Reports about attacks on this pipeline are alarming the West." In a Der Spiegel interview, Richard Morningstar, Bill Clinton's chief BTC pipeline negotiator, warns against Russia. Quote, Spiegel: "There are media reports about bombing attacks on the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline leading from Azerbaijan to Turkey via Georgia. It had been shut down last week. Is the pipeline under attack? There is evidence of a pattern of bombings near the pipeline. The BTC pipeline has been shut down."
And, Ralph, it has been reported that that report of bombings of the pipeline is false, just as most of the reports have been false. And Human Rights Watch has talked about what the Georgians have done. Yes, go ahead.
Morningstar sets out the agenda for confrontation. "The events of the past week show how critical it is that the United States and Europe coordinate with respect to energy policy. We must work together, finding alternative sources of energy and to make dependence on Russia and access of Russia increasingly less." You see the agenda of the Grand Chessboard spelled out in the context. Meanwhile, the New York Times, in its editorial on August 16th, called "The New Chill," "Russia's brazen invasion of Georgia raises a host of chilling questions that Americans and others had hoped were long settled. Is Russia a threat now to its neighbors, to Europe, to the United States? What do the United States and its NATO allies do when Russia blackmails and attacks another sovereign democratic nation, not a member of the alliance? Should the West engage Russia to contain its ambitions? President Bush has begun a crisis-induced reassessment of America's ties with Russia. His successor will have to revise it and implement that revision. Mr. Bush's father deftly managed the Soviet Union's dissolution. President Clinton did a good job managing Russia's post-Cold War decline. After criticizing Clinton for placing too much faith in Boris Yeltsin, Mr. Bush has placed too much faith in Vladimir Putin. Mr. Bush and the Europeans look the other way as Putin has throttled the free press, jailed political rivals, and used Russia's oil and gas riches to blackmail neighbors." This is the New York Times, the audacity. "The U.S.'s aggression across the planet, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and indeed in the Caspian Basin itself, setting out its policy like a Mein Kampf." And here is the New York Times, providing cover for imperialism. "Mr. Bush turned a deaf ear to Russia. We opposed NATO expansion, but once it began, we agreed Russia could not have veto power. President Bush fueled Russian nationalism and made Mr. Putin's job easier when he insisted on building unproven missile defense systems in this country, and then another in Central Europe, and now Poland this week." And then the New York Times goes on, "Russia must understand. There will be no business as usual as long as it continues its policies in Georgia and continues to threaten its neighbors." And it says, The New York Times, Bush is bequeathing his successor a world of troubles in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan, but the next president will have to deal with an increasingly hostile Russia. And here, indeed, is the headline in Der Spiegel along these lines, the West must stop Putin. The West needs to get tough to contain Russia's newfound imperialism in the wake of military action in Georgia. Russia has shown the world it won't shy away from using tanks to enforce its geopolitical interests, and the West has shown it doesn't have leverage to halt Russia's newfound imperialism. The article goes on.
Ralph, I think at this point we should bring in the role of Israel, because Israel has been a very important player in the attack on Russia. And as Debka noted on August 8th, Israel backs Georgia in Caspian oil pipeline battle with Russia. Specifically, Debka writes, Georgian tanks and infantry, aided by Israeli military advisors, captured the capital of breakaway South Ossetia early Friday, August 8th, bringing the Georgian-Russian conflict over the province to a military climax. These articles in Debka show clearly the role of the Israelis. As the Jerusalem Post also noted on August 12th, Hamat Magen Company, a private military advisory company, had been formed by the Galilee Division Commander, Brigadier General Gal Hirsch, and they provided advisors. As well, the firm owned by Major General Yisrael Zier, who's the former director of the Israeli Defense Forces Operations Directorate, that is the overall framework of the IDF, he too was involved with the Georgian military. And most of all, Israel has been supplying Georgia with arms, selling arms to Georgia and propping up the Georgian military, as well as the United States sending in military forces as advisors. In Haaretz, we have an article on August 14th, Georgia president denies Israel halted military aid due to the war. And this is important because other newspapers had reported that Israel had backed up, but we have Anshel Pfeiffer, the Haaretz correspondent, putting the lie to that. Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili denied that Israel had suspended its military aid to the country. In fact, what he says, the Israeli weapons have proved very effective, he said at a press conference in his office. And when asked whether the Israeli arms played a role in the military successes, he said, are you asking me as a representative of Elbit or of Israel Aerospace Industries, referring to two large companies of Israel who have supplied weapons? And furthermore, was asked about the involvement of Israel in the formation of his cabinet. And what he said is, quote, we have two Israeli cabinet ministers. Note that he didn't say we have two Jewish cabinet ministers. He said we have two Israeli cabinet ministers. One deals with war. This is the defense minister. And the other with negotiations, the state minister for territorial integration, that is in bringing in the breakaway territories of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. He says, this is the Israeli involvement here. Both war and peace are in the hands of Israeli Jews. Ralph?
Maya, the documentation in the Israeli press of the critical role of Israeli, along with U.S. Special Forces, but in particular the critical role of the Israeli Mossad and the Israeli military and the Israeli cabinet in imposing the government in Georgia and in orchestrating it has been well documented here. War in Georgia, the Israeli connection, is an article in Israel News by Ari Egozi. For the past 7 years, Israeli companies have directed the Georgian army in preparing for war against Russia through arms deal, training of units, and with security. The fighting which broke out, and this is the article in Israel News of August 10th, between Russia and Georgia has brought Israel's intense involvement into the limelight. This includes the sale of advanced weapons to Georgia and the total training of Georgia's army and infantry forces. The defense ministry held a special meeting Sunday to discuss the various arms deals held by Israelis in Georgia. And a delineation of this, as you were indicating it, is that Israel was providing these arms for 7 years, contacting defense industry officials and arms dealers. Georgia's large budgets were directed to the purchase of Israeli weapons. The military cooperation between the countries followed. Georgia's defense minister, David Kezashvili, is a former Israeli, fluent in Hebrew, who in fact was linked to Israeli military and intelligence services. And the defense minister's, quote, door was open always to the Israelis who came and provided arms systems made in Israel. Compared to countries in Eastern Europe, the deals in these countries were conducted fast due to the defense minister's direct control and involvement. Among the Israelis who took advantage of the opportunity and were doing business in Georgia were former Israeli minister Roni Milo, his brother Shlomo, who was the Director General of Military Industries, Brigadier General Gal Hirsch, and Major General Yisrael Zif. Roni Milo conducted business in Georgia for Elbit Systems and Military Industries. And this is the Israeli news. With his help, Israel's defense industries sold Georgia remote piloted vehicles, automatic turrets for their armored vehicles, anti-aircraft systems, communication systems, shells, and rockets. According to Israeli sources, Gal Hirsch gave the Georgian army advice on the establishment of elite units such as Sayarat Matkal, which means in Hebrew the scouts, and preparations for full rearmament, in-depth courses on combat intelligence and fighting in built-up areas. The Israelis operating in Georgia convinced Israeli aerospace industries to sell special systems to the Georgian Air Force. And indeed, Israel's activity in Georgia and the deals they struck there were, quote, all authorized by the defense ministry. As the tension between Russia and Georgia grew, there were voices in the foreign minister calling on the defense ministry to be more discreet. It was clear that there were too many unmistakable Israeli systems at the top of the Georgian army. It would be like a red cloth in the face of a raging bull as far as Russia is concerned. The Russians viewed the operation of the Elbit RBVs as a total provocation. Quote, it is clear the Russians are very angry, says a defense establishment source. The interception of three of these RPVs in the 3 months is an expression of their anger. Not everyone in Israel understood the sensitive nerve of Israel is touched when providing such direction and advanced arms system to a country whose relations with Russia are tense. The Georgian minister, the Israelis should be proud of themselves for the training they provided Georgian soldiers, said Georgian minister Timur Yakubashvili. Yakubashvili is fluent in Hebrew. Quote, we are now in a fight against Great Russia. We are receiving assistance from the White House. It is important that the entire world understands that what is happening in Georgia will affect the entire world order. This is not Georgia's business alone. It is the entire world's business. This is again the Israeli press, the reporters by Zvi Zinger and Hanan Greenberg. One of the Georgian parliament members who was privy to all this urged Israel to stop the Russian offensive as well. We need help from the United States and Israel. Today, it is Georgia. Tomorrow, all the democratic countries in the region and the world will be in danger without the United States and Israel. There is no ambiguity about this. Haaretz. Georgian Jews flee to Israel as clashes with Russia continue. And it delineates how these special units of Israeli intelligence and military were being removed from Georgia quickly so as to avoid their capture by the Russians. And here is Press TV. Israel has a hand in the South Ossetia War. Israel has provided Georgia with direction, with planning, and with instigation of the armed conflict in the breakaway region of South Ossetia. The Israeli website Debka Files, with close links with the regime's intelligence and military sources, has acknowledged that last year Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili commissioned from Israel's security firms over 1,000 top military advisors to prepare the country's armed forces for attack. The Israeli advisors helped Tbilisi with military intelligence, security operations. Georgia purchased their weapons intelligence and electronic warfare systems from Israel. The Israeli advisors were, quote, deeply involved in the direct preparations for the capture of the capital of South Ossetia on Friday. Its military experts, as a saying, pumped Caspian oil and gas to the Turkish terminal of Ceyhan in the interests of Tel Aviv. The regime is negotiating with Turkey, Georgia, Turkmenistan, and Afghanistan and Azerbaijan for the construction of these pipelines to transfer oil to terminals in Ashkelon and Eilat. We are only at the very beginning, brothers and sisters, of an understanding of what are the dynamics in Georgia, what are the underlying politics of this all-out assault upon the territorial integrity of Russia. It requires no romanticization of that former KGB director and corporate oligarch Putin, but nonetheless, he commands the imperial interests of Russia, and he is confronted by a U.S. imperium that would strangle his country, cut off its resources, surround it with enemies, and prepare for its dissolution. Those are the politics, those are the forces, and those are the stakes, because it means permanent war, brothers and sisters.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Grand Chessboard, 11 Years Later, Part 1, Target Russia, The Crisis in Georgia, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please visit our archive. Also, please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. Next week, we will discuss more about the Grand Chessboard 11 years later, particularly a series of articles that appeared in the Asia Times, a pipeline into the heart of Europe.
Tikin tikin do bin yai, ta tan ta tin da ta do ta tan ta.